Good afternoon, and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we take you to the Muskie School of Public Service at the University of Southern Maine for a forum entitled Examining Maine Care's Coverage Options Under the Affordable Care Act. The speakers are Joseph Antos, Wilson H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at American Enterprise Institute, and Sarah Rosenbaum, Harold and Jane Hirsch Professor of Health Law and Policy at George Washington University School of Public Health Services. Please note that due to time constraints, we were not able to bring you the panel discussion that followed these two speakers. However, a complete version of this forum can be found on our website, mpbn.net. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Peter Mills, Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority. Also note that Trish Riley of the Muskie School of Public Service will facilitate this forum.
Okay, it's Monday morning. Let's get started. I'm Peter Mills, and my only claim to fame here today is that I'm a member of the Board of Visitors of the Muskie School, and I'm playing hooky from the turnpike in order to kick this off this morning and turn it over to far more competent people to lead this discussion. It's an issue, healthcare in broader terms has been an issue that I've always been fascinated by ever since I got into public service myself back in 1994. After 16 years in the legislature, you begin to realize that healthcare and social services more broadly has become really the defense department of state government, superseding completely the former largest department of all during the mid part of the 20th century, the largest component of state government was the Department of Transportation. And now the Department of Human Services is easily six times bigger, even though DOT is probably as big as it ever was. Healthcare is 17% of our gross national product. We spend almost $3 trillion a year on it. Other countries of comparable wealth would say that we should be spending something like $1 trillion less. It's almost a 7% sales tax, I like to say, on almost everything that America produces. There are few institutions quite so well positioned, frankly, to contribute to this discussion than the Muskie School. Headed by Dean Joseph McDonald, who's here today. The Muskie School is a place where, I always like to say, it's a place where smart people know how to count things, solve problems, and bring management efficiency to things that defy management. The Muskie School comes in two parts. It's a place where you can take a degree in public health, public policy and management, community planning and development, or geography and anthropology. And on the other side, it is a research institution, the largest in the University of Maine complex, where you can perform studies in health policy, population health, children, youth and family services, disability and aging, and justice policy. We want to thank today the Maine Health Access Foundation for providing a small grant to support what we're doing here today. The question presented in this first of a series, what we hope to be a series of colloquia, today's question is whether Maine or any other state should accept the federal offer to expand Medicaid to 138% of the poverty level. We need to pause briefly here to thank those who put this together, Maureen Booth, who's on the staff, Meredith Eistreicher, Dan Roach, Sarah Litwiller, Julie Freilich, Donna Reed, Erica Ziller and Trish Riley. Erica and Trish are the authors of that marvelous eight-pager that has been put out that explains all the mysteries of Medicaid expansion. Erica is a doctorate, has a doctorate from the Muskie School and is on staff here. We want to start this morning with presentations from Joseph Antos, who is the William H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. And he will be pointing out why Maine should pause and reflect on whether to expand or to adopt the Medicaid expansion that's presently proposed by federal law. On the other side of that question is Sarah Rosenbaum, who is the Harold and Jane Hirsch Professor of Health Law and Policy at GW University, School of Public Health and Health Service. Then, after when we reach the halfway point, we want to broaden the discussion by bringing up a panel of people that most of you may know. Mary Mayhew, who is the commissioner of the Maine Department of Health and Human Services, the woman who no one can understand how she gets a night's sleep, but she always looks perky every morning. The world is on her shoulders. Dr. David Howes, who's president of Martin's Point Health Center, Martin's Point Healthcare, and then Sarah Gagne-Holmes, who's the executive director of Maine Equal Justice Partners. Guiding us through all of this will be the inimical Trish Riley, who's the adjunct professor of health policy at the Muskie School, and all of you know Trish, and she's worn many hats in health policy here in Maine over the years, and well-known nationally as well, the author of many articles and pieces on healthcare, and has been very active all her life. I think what I'd like to do is to turn it over to Trish, who will guide us into presenting the two speakers who will kick this off. Each will have about 10 minutes, and then they will have a chance to make a rebuttal presentation to you for 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll move ahead. Thank you for coming. I'm personally, as a citizen of Maine, very enthusiastic about this series being promoted by the Muskie School. I think it's a wonderful role for the school to adopt. And thank you, Trish.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. And Peter, thank you for all that you do for Muskie and for the state of Maine. Let me just sort of walk through the drill today. We will, as Peter mentioned, have Sarah Rosenbaum will make the case for expansion. Joe Antos will make the case against. They'll then do 5 minutes of rebuttal back and forth. And we'll take questions of clarification. You all have little sheets at your table. Because we do have to do written questions to accommodate MPBN, please, there'll be runners around. Runners, identify yourselves. The runners will be available, so as Sarah and Joe are speaking, if questions come up, please make sure you get those to us so we can follow up quickly after their remarks. And we will follow after that with the panel that Peter discussed. It's my pleasure to introduce two really national experts to join our Maine experts here today. I'll introduce them each as they get up to speak. Sarah Rosenbaum, as Peter mentioned, is a lawyer. She's the Hirsch Professor of Health Law and Policy at GW. She formerly chaired the Department of Health Policy and briefly the Department of Global Health, as I recall. She's a gifted teacher very well known in her writings across health policy. She was a member of the White House Domestic Policy Council under President Clinton, where she drafted the Health Security Act for Hillary Clinton. She's currently a member of the Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission, is widely quoted, and I don't think that Robert Peer writes a story in the New York Times that doesn't quote Sarah, and I would commend to you the GPS on health reform that the GW School of Public Health makes available, where Sarah posts at a regular basis, trying to compete with Mary Mayhew for not ever sleeping, ever. Sarah Rosenbaum to make the case.
Thank you very much for including me in this wonderful colloquium today. I think, Trish, I was trying to remember whether we have known each other for 30 years or 28 years or some number of years, but there is simply nobody better in health policy anywhere than Trish Riley. I was so honored when she asked me to come up, and I'm delighted to be here with Joe Antos, who is an old friend and colleague from Washington, D.C. So it's my job to make the case. And, of course, Joe and I have the great, I think the great luxury, and it is a luxury when even when you know things nationally, it is always sort of an interesting experience to look at something with eyes from the outside. And so our job is to look at the picture from the outside and give you our thoughts about where the state should go. After I got done reading the marvelous materials that Trish prepared for this with other folks at the university and the other materials on Maine's situation, it struck me that the question here really is not why should Maine take the new expansion. The issue really is why should Maine continue to cover its poorest citizens? This is an unusual situation that you have in Maine. You are covering a great proportion of the people who are going to be entitled to coverage under the Medicaid expansion. And unlike a state like Texas or Florida, where the issue really is whether the state should move forward and why, here the question is whether you roll back. And I think the dynamics of framing the question that way cast the discussion and the issues that lie on on your minds in a bit of a different light. And I've identified six reasons, as far as I'm concerned, why Maine ought to continue to cover your poorer citizens. The first one is the sheer population health impact of rolling back coverage at this point. You have tens of thousands of extremely poor people who today have some coverage, have coverage through a program that has proven itself over nearly a half century, despite a whole lot of slings and arrows that are thrown against it. The uninsured have a 40% higher mortality rate than the insured. These are issues that must have weighed on your mind at the time that you pursued the expansion. The burden of unmanaged illnesses and disabilities on people who don't have appropriate insurance, of course, much higher than those who are insured. So what you are poised to do is, I think, if you don't continue the coverage, is to take a step back on a crucial population health measure, one that goes to the health of the whole state. And you can see it in the state statistics. You can see it in the extent to which the expansion has achieved a dramatic effect, actually, on the proportion of people who are uninsured in Maine compared to those who are uninsured in other states, particularly poorer states. The second reason is that, quite frankly, Medicaid is the only pathway we've got. The Affordable Care Act makes sure this is a statutory matter. This is not a matter of administration discretion. The Affordable Care Act basically says that for people under 100% of poverty, there is no pathway other than Medicaid. If you are not a citizen, there is, ironically. You can come in through the exchange. If you are a citizen and you are under 100% of poverty, there is no way, unless a state certainly decides to use its own funds to pay for your coverage. So there is no other pathway. You can hope, of course, against hope that maybe Maine's employers are able to extend coverage. I will tell you that your employer figures here are below the already abysmally low employer standards for coverage of poor workers. Nationally, it's about 17%. Here in Maine, the latest available data I was able to find show a coverage level of about 14%. So, I mean, there is no employer-sponsored system for low-income workers here because a lot of your employers are small and low-wage employers themselves. They can't afford this. And so if you don't take this pathway, there really is nothing. No exchange credits, no employer coverage. Obviously, Medicare doesn't start until people hit the age of 65. And unless the state wants to fund this itself, Medicaid is the pathway. The third reason is that the gains are considerable, as are the losses if you don't continue the coverage. The enormous infusion of federal funds to the state under the formula that applies under the Affordable Care Act is one that will bring hundreds of millions of dollars into the state. This is a poor state. It's a state with an economy that is frail. You have a lot of young workers who need good jobs. You have a lot of older people who really need the support of insurance. But the economic value of the expansion for a relatively modest state outlay is considerable. The funds into your localities as a result of new jobs and the economic impact, obviously, of infusing healthcare financing into localities is enormous. And if you don't pick up this option, there are certain costs that are just tremendous. One is, of course, the loss of the funding to the state. This is funding that the state's taxpayers have already paid for. It's your federal funding at work coming back to you. If it doesn't, if you don't continue the coverage, it doesn't come back to you. It is a huge loss of funds for the state's hospitals on top of what will begin in 2014, again, under the statute itself, which is a huge reduction in disproportionate share hospital payments under both Medicare and Medicaid. And it's a huge cost shift onto employers. If you end coverage for low-income people, everybody's employer-sponsored benefits feels it. The state of Maryland, during the Affordable Care Act litigation, estimated that the cost shift in the state from having such a high proportion of uninsured people translated into about $1,000 a year extra in the cost of a family premium. So this is a huge financial blow to struggling employers. It is the reason, quite frankly, more than any other, why Massachusetts took the pathway it did, because of the cost shift onto employers. So at two levels, both the boon to low-wage, small employers whose workers are earning less than the federal poverty level who need this coverage, and the impact of not continuing the coverage because you lose the funds that otherwise would help other employers in the state control the cost of their coverage. The fourth reason is the flexibility that the expansion offers. HHS has made it clear that while there are certain things it cannot waive in the law, it is extremely willing to work with states on premium support, on premium assistance innovations, on service delivery innovations. I think that you find a federal government that's quite open to thinking about how it makes the most sense to bring up a Medicaid expansion in the 21st century. Fifth reason is that Medicaid is transforming regardless of whether you continue the coverage of your poorest citizens. Medicaid will change because of other provisions of the Affordable Care Act that essentially introduce a new way of thinking about and running the program. The act is really transformational to Medicaid. It is meant in this new era to work in alignment with the exchange up here. It is meant to be a partner with the exchange. It is meant to be able to keep people who have low wages and whose incomes fluctuate continuously insured. So the transformation is happening with or without a decision to hold the line for your poorer citizens. And finally, and I will close here, I think to me the strongest argument for the preservation of the expansion you've already enacted via a waiver and other state plan reforms, and that is really the spectacle of having health reform go forward on January 1, 2014, with your poorest citizens having just lost their coverage, which is exactly what the situation will be. They will have lost their coverage on December 31st, 2013. On January 1, 2014, when health reform begins in Maine, you will have just disinsured tens of thousands of the state's poorest citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. And now to make the case against expansion, we are pleased to have Joe Antos here. In addition to being the Taylor Scholar for Healthcare and Retirement at the American Enterprise Institute, Joe comes with an extraordinary background himself. He has a PhD in economics. He's written widely on the economics of health policy. He served in the past, he's got some state experience, having served, I think, two terms on the Maryland Commission on rate review, that's the Hospital Rate Setting Commission in Maryland. He served under the Reagan and Bush administrations and for a short time under the Clinton administration in a number of very important positions. In addition, he was the Assistant Director for Health at the Congressional Budget Office. He served in high leadership positions in HCFA, the Healthcare Financing Administration, now known as CMS, and in the Secretary's Office. And he was a senior economist at the Office of Management and Budget. So with that extraordinary background, Joe Antos, the case against.
Thanks, Trish. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here. Well, the pleasure was last night. I had a nice lobster, and so it's an honor to be here. I'm not going to make extreme claims about Maine or any other state not doing something. I think Peter actually said it right. Which is that my position is that Maine should stop and think before they rush into anything. All the states should do that. And an expansion under certain terms may make some sense. And the question is, what are those terms? So I think there are really three perspectives that one needs to consider. You have to decide which perspective is the most important one, but I think all three matter. First of all, there's the state or the taxpayer. It's basically, will the state end up spending more or less money? That's always an issue in every state, Maine especially. Second one, providers, and in particular hospitals, how will they do under an expansion? And then the third one, the one that usually or often is overlooked, although not in Maine, is how will the average citizen or the potential beneficiary of this, those are two different groups, but the potential beneficiary and citizens in general, how will they fare under this expansion? So those are the three perspectives, and then I have a series of questions. What's the best deal you can get? I think that's a real issue. It may not be the same from each of these perspectives. The state perspective may, in fact, differ from the hospitals or certainly from the potential beneficiaries, low-income people. And then whatever the best deal is, should you take it? That's a good question. And that is a political question. It's a financial question. It is a philosophical question for some people. I'm going to stay away from philosophy. I'm merely an economist. So there's considerable uncertainty about what the best deal could be, partly because the rules remain unclear, partly because the best deal may not actually be on the table yet. There's also the challenge of knowing the best course under Maine circumstances. As Sarah said, Maine is not like other states, and so you have to carefully consider your individual circumstances here. But in particular, since Maine expanded coverage prior to the health reform changes, what do you do about that? And of course, this comes to Sarah's final point, which is what happens when the waiver expires? What do you do either then, or what do you do before that? I think that's a fair question. In addition, every state, of course, grapples with basic budget questions. What is the best balance between spending on health and spending on everything else? I understand from Peter that a lot more money should go into roads. I respect that. Exactly. But joking aside, that is a legitimate concern. How much do we want to put into healthcare? How much do we want to put into everything else? Because the everything else matters too in every state. Whatever you decide there, am I willing to raise taxes now or in the future to finance that overall level of state spending? I don't want to have that question be focused solely on health. I think it oftentimes in health policy discussions, everybody imagines that there's nothing else. In fact, there's plenty of other things that we need to worry about and priorities. So here are six issues that I won't get to fully, but I'll try. If there is an expansion, will the state reduce its spending on Medicaid, either in the short term or the long term? I think the answer to that one is that in the short term, it does look like a pretty good deal. But remember that the 100% money or the higher match rate for the people that you have already covered, the young adults that you've already covered, that which is not 100%, by the way, that that tapers down to 90%, or in the case of your situation, it tapers up to 90%. But the fact is that it's not 100%. And it's not 100%. Even if it were 100%, it wouldn't be 100% forever. So when you see these analyses that say that there's going to be a lot more money into the state, that's a short-term analysis. The question is, over the long term, what do you expect to see? And do you expect to see savings? And the savings, by the way, the savings estimates that you see from the Urban Institute assume that the state will take severe actions to cut back on its payment of disproportionate share payments to hospitals. That's extra payments to hospitals for paying for services of people who don't have coverage. So that's in most states, that's a tough thing to do. Then, will the tax base increase? This is something that people often say in other states. I'm not sure so much about Maine. But they'll say, well, you know, there's all that extra money, and all that money will somehow infuse the state with more jobs. Well, there might be more jobs in healthcare, but in fact, there is little evidence that this kind of stimulus spending, at least over the last 6 or 7 years, actually increases employment. So will the tax base increase? It's not entirely clear. What about the number of uninsured? Will the number of uninsured decline? Again, it's not so clear. If that's one of your objectives, then you also have to be concerned about the extent to which employers drop their coverage, or people drop out of employer coverage and move to Medicaid. Sarah said that you don't have much of an employer-sponsored insurance sector. I think that may be a little misleading. You have a lot of seasonal workers. It isn't entirely clear to me what the statistics really tell you about that. But from what I've read, big expansion the last time, in fact, drew a lot of people from employer-sponsored coverage. Fourth, will the hospitals gain or lose compared to the alternative? This goes back to this question about whether the state is actually willing to cut these additional payments for uncompensated care, and whether to what extent people in Maine, low-income people, actually sign up for Medicaid. This is very difficult. But one fact is completely clear, which is that hospitals across the country always complain that Medicaid doesn't pay them enough. And so if you expand the Medicaid program from the hospital's perspective, they can't be 100% sure that they're going to be gaining, because they're going to get a lot more Medicaid people in their patient base. I suspect that the hospitals in Maine feel the same way as every other hospital, which is, those payment rates are way too low. And the question is, what happens to the uncompensated care payments? What happens to payment rates that Maine will set? Not necessarily this year, not necessarily next year, but ultimately there will be more pressure on the state legislature to increase payment rates to hospital to make up for the fact that now there are a lot more Medicaid patients going to the hospital. Fifth, will the poor gain better access to care? I think this is the one question that bothers me the most. There is a waiting list in Maine. Low-income people who can't get services. If you pour more people into the Medicaid program, you're going to have a bigger problem. In my state, Maryland, even though it's a highly regulated state, it's still the case that People on Medicaid have a great deal of difficulty getting access to specialty care, for example. If you want a specialist, you better hope that you have run into a doctor at some point in your life, perhaps in a pre-clinic, who can call a friend. If you have something that's seriously wrong with you, you're going to need help, you're going to need specialty care, and that is tough to come by. And there's no evidence, by the way, that expanding Medicaid reduces the mortality rate. It's a lot less clear about health status. Mortality rate is something you can measure. Health status is, in general is much harder to measure. But Medicaid is not the ideal program from an access standpoint. We all know that. And then finally, is there a better way? And I think Sarah alluded to this a little bit. The idea that the administration would support innovation in a Medicaid, maybe, but maybe not right now. Maybe they need to wait. The fact is that where the administration is coming from right now is that we've got our rules, we've interpreted them a certain way, and this is what we want. The latest. It's not really a regulation. It's guidance to the states. The latest guidance basically says that you can't really change anything about for example, the cost-sharing requirements in Medicaid. There essentially are no cost-sharing requirements. And if you're going to expand coverage, that means that it's going to be very difficult for a state like Maine, which doesn't use managed care plans in its Medicaid program, to manage the cost, to direct people to more efficient providers and so on. Now, Maine could make some changes along those lines, but that's something that's going to take some time to do. That's not something you're going to accomplish by the end of this year. Everybody's heard about Arkansas and their proposal to put all of their Medicaid beneficiaries into the exchanges to take advantage of big subsidies for people over 100% of poverty and to make the exchanges work better somehow. It's an interesting theory. It is true that Arkansas has an awful lot of people who would be on the Medicaid program if they expanded. And there would be not so many people in the exchanges for private insurance. They're hoping that would cause the plans to have more negotiating power with hospitals, for example. By the way, hospitals, that means less money for you. But is that really true? It isn't at all clear. Because if, in fact, the Medicaid plan that is available, it's going to be the lowest cost plan because Medicaid people won't have the money to pay any extra. That plan will also have to adhere to all of the federal rules related to Medicaid. It's going to be a very difficult thing to pull off. And in fact, unless the federal government is willing to pay a lot more money to the Arkansas, then what you'll have is you'll have a Medicaid plan. And then you'll have all the other plans for all the other people. That doesn't look like a very attractive approach. What your governor says is that he wants 100% funding for 10 years. I think that's unrealistic. However, the idea of that's 100% for the expansion population, and I believe he defines the expansion population to include the people who would fall off the waiver. That doesn't, 10 years, I think, is probably not on the books, not this year. Who knows what will happen 3 or 4 years from now? But this year, not so much. But the Obama administration wants to see every state have expansions, wants to see big increases in the number of people who have insurance. And so they're going to be a lot more malleable in September than they are today. So I think that's, when you think about your strategy, you should consider the timing. Thank you.
As you were talking, I had this image in my head. I don't know how many people have ever seen the movie No Country for Old Men. There's that wonderful character played by Javier Bardem who delivers this line that Joe's discussion made me think of right away, which is this is the best deal you're going to get. I think there are really crucial things that Maine can negotiate over in exchange for a continuation of coverage of its poorest citizens. And I think, actually, one place where I disagree with Joe is I think the negotiating office is open today. I think the White House is furiously negotiating with states now. And I assume that when Secretary Mayhew sent her letter, it's because everybody here is acutely aware of the fact that negotiations are ongoing. What do I think you can negotiate over is sort of exactly the points Joe made. How are you going to organize your delivery system and coverage arrangements under the formal 2014 expansion as opposed to how you might have done things under your 1115 waiver? How are you going to pay your providers? The issue of hospital payments is, of course, not written in stone. The state has the immense legal authority. It is cloaked in great powers, as immense powers, as President Lincoln said, to decide what its hospital payment policies are going to be going forward. And certainly the point Joe raises of a situation in which Medicaid is no longer a marginal payer, but really quite a central payer, may cause a rethinking of how providers get paid generally under the program. And the enhanced federal funding, in my view, gives you the opportunity to think about these things with some greater care. And then, of course, there is the potential to use premium assistance for some, if not all, of the expansion population, the group of people who are close to around the federal poverty level. There are two things that aren't up to Maine in this negotiation, and this is actually not up to the White House either. One is the availability of premium credits below the federal poverty level. That is simply a non-starter. It doesn't happen. It can't exist. Only in the case of legally present people, and not in the case of citizens, are premium credits available if you're under poverty. So it's going to be the it's going to be the Medicaid money or no money. I think whether we frame it as an industry issue or a custom issue, the fact is that Maine's industries, either because they're seasonal or because they're lower wage or for a combination of those reasons, these are not industries that are structured to be big in employer-sponsored coverage. It's just not. It's not in the nature of the kind of industry that the state relies on. It is not bad. It's not good. It's just sort of what is. So you got Medicaid to work with. And that's the only source of funds up to federal poverty. And the other point is that the secretary can't waive the FMAP. Can't waive the federal contribution. So in other words, if a decision is made that Maine is what's called an expansion state and that therefore its newly eligible population is lower than it might be in some of the other states, it is absolutely true that the federal contribution will be lower. The federal contribution is still, as I understand it, about 20 points higher and going up from there. Such an extraordinary leap over the contribution that you get today that the state is one of the few states in the country that actually sees a savings, assuming that the coverage is not ended for the poor at the end of 2013.
So on that last point, again, the savings that at least the Urban Institute estimates assumes that the state is willing to cut the uncompensated care payments to hospitals. Considering that the state owes hospitals
million.
You know,
it's real money.
I get confused because in Washington, a number below $100 billion is round off for me. So I'm a little puzzled about state financing. That kind of adds up. The idea of having that debt and at the same time pushing through a further reduction seems politically difficult to me. It's not impossible, of course, but I think that the savings estimates that people have come up with are unrealistic, much like most of these estimates are. You don't really know what's going to happen in the future. As far as the White House being willing to negotiate seriously, we can have some disagreement about that. I think Arkansas is the bellwether. So there the governor comes out of a meeting with Secretary Sebelius and says, oh boy, this is really something. You know, we've got an agreement here. And the secretary says in a statement, it's an interesting idea. Got an agreement. Interesting idea. Yeah, let me see the paperwork. And the key here, of course, is it actually possible for Arkansas or anybody else to get more money? HHS has asserted incredible powers above and beyond those of mortal men. I don't know Lincoln, but I do know Superman. But you know that those powers can turn on and off. HHS pushed to the states the requirement to come up with an essential benefits package for the exchanges. Why? Because they were incapable of figuring out how to do that for each state. The law is pretty clear. The secretary shall. The secretary didn't. There are lots of other circumstances that are somewhat more obscure where the secretary decided to do one thing versus another that plain reading of the statute suggests that you can't do. So is it really true that there is absolutely no way for the White House to decide that a state is worthy of some additional payment in some form? I don't think so. I think there's always a way. Maryland is a great example of that. We've had a Medicare waiver since the early 70s, and the result is that Maryland hospitals have gotten about $100 million a year, maybe $200 million a year recently, more than they would have under current rules. So I think there's always a way, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a Medicaid way. You got to think more broadly. Just as you have to think about what the consequences are more broadly, you have to also think about the potential opportunities more broadly. I guess the last point I would make is it just has to do with the business about how Medicaid is supposed to operate in tandem with the exchanges to make sure that people are continuously covered. This is the theory of one-stop shopping. There will be no one-stop shopping in this country. People have talked about the 15-page application form. They've talked less about the 61-page questionnaire that the so-called navigator will take you through to determine whether you're eligible for a subsidy. And after you're through the 61 pages, guess what? The instruction is, well, you might be eligible for Medicaid. Check with your state. So, in fact, the concern about having people going on and off with gaps in coverage is very real, is not resolved by this, because it's a legitimately difficult problem. This is not some simple computer programming issue. Every state has different rules. Maine is going to have the federal exchange. The federal exchange will be incapable of tailoring its software to each individual state in this regard because it's just too complicated. And furthermore, poor people generally don't have access to computers and are going to have a hard time understanding what's going on. So the pressure is going to be on the state to find some way to have human beings talk to human beings about connecting them up to healthcare. Good idea. It's expensive. You'll be paying for that.
Let me try to get the audience has no questions. There's 604 pieces of paper here. Many of them are around single payer, and I will say that single payer is the discussion for next colloquium. On the 22nd, we'll have Vermont here, so we're going to try to focus on those questions that come before it. If we get to time for single payer, we'll go there. But we have a number of questions about costs. Let me just rip through them because they all are of a theme, I think. How would declining the expansion cost shift dollars to employer-sponsored plans, given that Sarah points out that low-wage workers tend not to have employer-sponsored plans? Can you explain why having main care, waiting lists, specialty referrals, hospital payments could ever be worse than no insurance? You emphasize increased hospital costs due to lower payments. Are there profits of hospitals sacrosanct? Are there models of efficiency that can be added here? And there was a final question on Maine has received a new SIM grant from the federal government, state innovation model, that's going to allow the state to really restructure how we pay for things. What's the data about can we get better costs? Are there efficiencies? Do we have to just say no to Medicaid because it's not an efficiently run program? Can it be better run in the future? So a whole bunch of cost-related, and I will leave it to whoever wants to go first.
Well, absolutely. It is entirely possible for health systems to improve their efficiency. It is entirely possible for clients of those health systems to be smarter about the kind of health care they get and when they get it and where they get it. And it's entirely possible for hospitals and doctors to do a better job. There's no question about that. The question is, how long will it take? Is Maine different in that regard than any other place? Is there some magic bullet here that nobody else has found? I'll tell you, Maryland hasn't found it, and we're a very highly regulatory state. And we put a lot of pressure on the hospitals over the last, it's been about 40 years to shape up. And, they haven't done a very good job. So, Maryland is a rich state. We can invest in things that I'm sure the Maine health system cannot. So you start in a hole, and the idea that you're going to be able to have vast improvements in efficiency under this kind of system, I think, is unreasonable, certainly in the short term. Over the long term, it's, of course, hard to say. The question is, what are the incentives that would drive hospitals? I'm going to pick on hospitals. They are the cost center of healthcare. If they don't shape up, then it's very difficult to see improvements elsewhere. So what is the incentive for a hospital to invest a lot of money into systems that might pay off 5 or 10 years down the road? This is a difficult question that all hospitals face. I don't think the expansion tells you anything about that. I think what we would expect to see is that essentially the costs that you now see in your health system are going to be the costs you're going to see in your health system for 5 years, 10 years, somewhere in there. So in the short term, you're stuck with spending the money, and then further out, I think the question is, can the program be restructured in a way so that in fact Medicaid beneficiaries become more active purchasers. They're not now. And will the hospitals pay greater attention to moving them out of the hospital and somewhere else? Remember, every admission is revenue. I think these are difficult questions.
So where Joe sees sort of a glass half empty, I see the opposite. I see a glass half full. I think the transformational thing about what is about to happen in Maine and every place else in the country is that Medicaid is in a position to be transformed, but no longer by itself. It becomes one of a four-legged stool holding up the American healthcare financing system. So there's Medicaid, Medicare, employer-sponsored coverage, and now this new market, the exchange. And while nobody pretends that the first few months, a couple of years, are going to be a bumpy ride for everybody as we get used to what it means to be in a virtually national health insurance system. And some of us may have wished it was done a different way, but here we are. We've cobbled together what we have in order to make it familiar to people. But when these programs go through sort of the looking glass of being disparate actors in healthcare finance to suddenly pieces of a system that is supposed to work together, I think that it becomes possible to have discussions with healthcare providers and delivery systems that weren't had before. So the Affordable Care Act contemplates this. I mean, it does it in 2,200 pages. It's a little hard to follow at times, I grant you that. But the act contemplated that we would go through sort of this looking glass of financing transformation, and then the hard work would begin. Maine is not going to be able to grapple with that hard work if you don't first insure everybody. And insuring everybody means using the Medicaid funds and getting that last leg of the stool in place. Then I totally agree with Joe that the place where you've really got to push is the Willie Sutton principle, is the place where the money is. You have way too much money going into institutional care in Maine, not enough money going into primary care, not enough connections between what happens in institutions and what happens in the primary care system. You have obviously a rural and quite disparate population, so there is the additional challenge of having to knit people together into virtual delivery systems. You won't have one place maybe where there are 200 doctors under one roof the way we have in Washington, D.C., but if you look at what the Marshfield Clinic does, what Geisinger does, they create virtual delivery systems for very far-flung providers. And it means a lot of new technology. It means some investment. It means putting pressure on hospitals to begin to turn around and start making these investments through the formation of restructured delivery arrangements, episode of care payments, bundled service payments, all of the things that you read about as sort of a lot of technobabble, but become very real once you're dealing with a population that's totally insured, so that a hospital doesn't sit there and say, I can't make these deals with you because I'm looking at, you know, one in X number of people in the state being uninsured and a source of uncompensated care. I don't think you can begin to do these things until you insure everybody.
So let me make a quick point here. One of the hallmarks of the ACA is that it didn't actually change anything substantial about the Medicare program. Medicare is the biggest payer in the country. And so the failure to change the structure of the Medicare program, the failure to really bring forward ideas other than the age-old and failed attempts to reduce payment rates, rather than changing the way healthcare is delivered, is really the problem here. I don't expect the Medicaid program in any state to take the lead. But the fact is that the Medicare program is the big block to a lot of things. Medicare is not only the biggest payer, but it also is the legal authority. And so a lot of things that we do in healthcare are driven by Medicare. The only good news here is that we have seen some slight reduction in the rate of growth, which is not a reduction in cost in healthcare in the last few years in general, but that hasn't been driven by Medicaid or Medicare. That has been driven by employer-sponsored coverage, and Maine's in trouble in that regard. If and I think you're probably right. There's just not a big enough presence here to be kind of the third force to push back.
I have two more questions, and then we'll bring the rest of the panel in. One specifically for Sarah, and one we'll close with for both of you. And this is about disproportionate share payments. And in Maine, as you know, the Medicaid DSH payments are used to match the are used to pay for the childless adult waiver. How do you explain disproportionate share to the general public, especially? And now this will test your teacherhood, especially how this system pays for care at the most expensive crisis phase of care rather than at the least expensive and more effective primary care phase?
Well, starting off with how do you explain DSH payments, basically I probably don't do any better than any of you who has to do this all the time. It's extra payments that go to certain hospitals because they see a higher volume of lower income people, and lower income people with certain attributes tend to cost more. Now, I assume that, of course, for a while the DSH revenues have been essentially removed as a direct funds flow to your hospitals and instead have flowed through the coverage arrangements for uninsured adults, yes. The big problem that's going to come in 2014 is that your waiver will end, of course, and whereas hospitals might have gotten their DSH funds back, they are not coming back. Medicare and Medicaid DSH funds both begin to drop. And so it's not as if, you know, if you're the hospitals, you sit and say, well, we're just sort of tired of insuring people. We'd rather be paid directly for our time. Thank you very much. We'll take our money back. And I'm sure actually that's probably not how hospitals think about it. But that assumption is wrong under the Act, because the Act, in order to pay for the expansions to low-income people, cut both Medicare and Medicaid DSH. I just want to note one last thing, one 30-second thing, which is I disagree with Joe on the issue of Medicare. I totally agree that a lot more could have been done to the Medicare program. I think, however, that a number of pieces, a number of basic reforms have been set in motion in how Medicare buys healthcare. And it's very important, as you begin to think about your innovations here, to look closely at what Medicare is in however a lurching format, going to try and do nationwide. Because the more multiple payers, and that's, of course, the meaning of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, is to try and get multiple payers, not just Medicare, moving in the same direction on certain kinds of reforms.
Okay, this is a political question. We'll get to end with this one. Isn't one of the political reasons from opponents not to enact Medicaid expansion the fact that as states do this, it will be harder and harder to undo or roll back the ACA? This is a yes or no question.
Yes.
Sure. But but whether you do, whether you expand or not, I mean, you think of it, we're talking about Maine now. Whether you expand or not, does anybody realistically think that what has been set into motion will simply disappear? Absolutely not. Things have permanently changed, probably not the way the administration imagines they've changed. And in 4 years, if there is a Republican president, they will be working off of whatever that is 4 years from
and
now.
And as my husband pointed out to me this morning, when the Republican governor of North Dakota is on a roll with the Republican legislature of North Dakota to get the Medicaid expansion into place post-haste, you know that we're never going back.
On that, let me thank Joe and Sarah, have them join us and bring up Mary Mayhew, Sarah Gagne-Holmes, and David. I know.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today we took you to a forum entitled Examining MaineCare's Coverage Options Under the Affordable Care Act. The speakers were Joseph Antos, Wilson H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at American Enterprise Institute, and Sarah Rosenbaum, Harold and Jane Hirsch Professor of Health Law and Policy at George Washington University School of Public Health Services. Please note that due to time constraints, we were not able to bring you the panel discussion that followed these two speakers. However, a complete version of this forum can be found on our website, mpbn.net. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine program, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine program, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to this program again at your convenience by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.